just a couple of not necessarily ground rules, but to help me. I'm going to try to stay close to the mic while I'm up here, but I know myself well enough that that's going to be a struggle. So if you start having trouble hearing, let me know, because it'd be silly for you to come and not be able to hear just because I haven't stayed close to the mic. Second thing is, when we would like to have questions, if you've got questions, Lowell's kind of got it set up so that we've got mics. I think maybe Paul's helping him. And so if you've got a question, raise your hand and I'll call on you, but one of those guys will probably try to get to you with a mic. Not that I'll have trouble hearing you, but there may be some others that might have trouble, and an answer doesn't mean a whole lot if you don't know what the question is. So we'd like to get those two dovetailed together. Okay, our topic is the Ten Commandments. And also, if you didn't bring a notebook or have pencil and paper, just let Lowell know, raise your hand, and we've got paper if anybody didn't bring it that does want it to take notes and so forth. So I don't see any hands, but if you change your mind, Lowell will be floating around. Yeah, Lisa. Okay. We're going to spend some time tonight on a little bit on an introduction, and then we're going to try to get into the first and maybe even complete the first of the Ten Commandments. I toyed with whether or not to do much of an introduction, because even if we did no introduction and tried to cover two commandments a night, that's moving at a pretty brisk pace. But I've come to the conclusion that if you don't understand how God gave the Ten Commandments, you really won't have an appreciation for the Ten Commandments. Another way of saying that is I've about concluded that the 19th chapter of Exodus is as important as the 20th chapter of Exodus, which is the actual articulation of the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are called by several things. In the 20th chapter of Exodus and in the 5th chapter of Deuteronomy, where we have the listing of the Ten Commandments, they're not called the Ten Commandments there. There are three other verses in the Bible that refer to them as the Ten Commandments. Sometimes as you're reading, you'll find them referred to as the Ten Commandments. Sometimes you'll refer to them as the Decalogue, which simply means the Ten Laws. If you go back to the basic Hebrew, they're referred to as simply the Ten Words. And in all probability, when God wrote them on the tablets, they were not phrases or sentences. They were one or two words at max. In a lot of languages, you can make a negative out of a positive by simply adding a suffix or a prefix. And I think that's probably what we saw in the Hebrew, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. This is just an overview that I know a lot of you are familiar with, but I wanted to go back and make sure that we all understood that this is the era we're talking about right here, because the introduction and the giving of the Ten Commandments, which was part of the law, but not all of the law, was the issuing in of the Mosaical Law. And while this graphic that I found shows the patriarchal by the Christian age, that's true for the Jewish nation, of course, but it's not true for the Gentile nation. The Gentile nation never had the Mosaical Law, so the law per se was not relevant to them, and the patriarchal age simply went over. But this also gives you some idea of what time we're talking about. We're talking probably about 1450 B.C. appears to be about the time when the children of Israel got to Mount Sinai and we're on their exit out of Egypt. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. I see a few of you copying, so I'll leave that up for just a...
Why do you have that
Mosaical? Well, it needs an I in there. Okay?
I didn't know that was something
new. No, it's something old. Okay? And that lasted for about 1,500 years, from about 1450 to about 30 A.D. Okay? Okay.
Now, the next overhead that I wanted to put up isn't with a culture intelligent, but it's to give you some idea of how they were probably written. First of all,
And those are the Ten Commandments. And I didn't. I won't ask you how many of you could have recited them coming in. But I seriously would like for all of us to be able to memorize those going out. It's not difficult. But in all probability, they were written in very short phrases, as the Hebrew would indicate, no gods. That lets me walk around. Thank you.
And the mosaic, the Ten Commandments. Are you helping me? Okay. The Ten Commandments, thank you, are in essence the foundation of most societies' ethical background. Almost every society that I've ever studied adheres to the principles of the Ten Commandments. The Babylonian societies, the Egyptian societies, even those that aren't monotheistic. And the Ten Commandments teach, first of all, a respect for God, the first four commandments. And the last six, they are social issues. They teach about getting along with mankind and how they are introduced. Now, most people would look at the Ten Commandments. Well, first of all, let me just ask you this question. Are the Ten Commandments applicable to us today? Pardon? Nine of them are, and probably the tenth one in principle is, if you'll move it to the Lord's Day rather than the Sabbath, okay? And nine of them specifically are carried over, okay? And I've just used the numbers of the Ten Commandments here and put some passages out to the side that would give us different places in the New Testament, and there's not countless, but there's numerous places. The first one, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." The reference in Acts 17, that's the account of where Paul went into the city of Athens and gave his dialogue on Mars Hill, and you'll know they had idols, and he gave them some articulation. Romans 1 and 2 about graven images, 1 and 23, that's where Paul's talking about how they turned the incorruptible God into a corruptible thing and worshiped things made with hands. Number 3, in the Sermon on the Mount, Christ talks about not swearing, not taking the Lord's name in vain. And you can kind of go down these. There, some of them are, this is the reference at Troas in Acts 20 and 7, where they did meet upon the first day of the week. Now, that's not the Sabbath, but that is, in principle, the first day of the week. Here, honoring the parents, Paul uses in Ephesians 6, almost the identical phraseology that you get out of the 20th chapter of Exodus. Thou shalt not kill. In the Sermon on the Mount, he says, not only should you not kill, you should not be angry. You should not be mad. You should not say raka to your brother. Okay, and on down here, the concept of adultery. In the Sermon on the Mount, Christ says, not only should you not commit adultery, but you take it one step further. You shouldn't even lust after a woman in your eye. On down to thou shalt not steal. Here, this is the account of the rich young ruler that came, and he says, I've kept all these things, and he lists that one, and Christ says, that's good, but then he tells him to go on and even go further. Here it says a similar thing in Romans 13 and 9. Thou shalt not bear false witness. It was also mentioned here in Matthew 19 and 18, and it's also referred to in Revelations 21 and 8, where it says, all liars shall have their place in hell fire. Okay? And then the last one, thou shalt not covet. Luke 12:15 says, thou shalt not covet. And also Romans 7:7. And there's other passages. My point is not to list all of the passages, but my point is to show rather briefly that the principles of the Ten Commandments are applicable to us. And in fact, nine of them are specifically carried over. But I think we can take it a step further, if you'll allow me to. I believe the principles of the Ten Commandments were applicable under the patriarchal law also. So this was not necessarily something new. And I'll just go down a few of these, and you'll be familiar with some of them. But on the first two, where it's talking about, thou shalt have no other gods before thee, and no other graven images. You remember the story in Genesis 31 and 35, where Rachel was coming back with Jacob. And you remember what she took, stole out of her father's house? Idols, graven images. And in Genesis 35, Jacob says, purify yourselves, talking to his people. Purify yourself from these strange gods. Now somehow, that principle was instilled in them by God, probably verbally. But somehow they knew it was wrong to have these idols and these graven images. If you go down to taking the Lord's name in vain, that's a little harder to find one. In Exodus chapter 3, where Moses is talking with God before he's sent down to Egypt, God simply says, I am that I am, and places a tremendous amount of respect around the name of Yahweh that we'll talk about in a little bit. Keeping the Sabbath holy, that was a principle that really started with creation, with the seventh day that God rested, as I was teaching the young children. I believe the first time the word Sabbath is mentioned in the Bible is in Exodus 16 and 23, the word Sabbath per se. But that was used in Exodus 16 prior to the commandment in Exodus 20 that says that you're to keep the Sabbath. So there was some realization of the Sabbath day and some principle established from the very beginning of creation. Honoring your father and mother, there was a lot of them I could have used for that. But you remember Noah's sons after the flood when one of them saw their father naked and didn't honor them? Somehow, they knew that principle went against God. Killing, I used Cain and Abel, but again, there's a plethora of them that I could have used. Somehow, killing was told to God's people that was something that was wrong. So these were eternal principles. Stealing. You remember when Joseph's brothers were coming out of Egypt and he'd sent them back with the grain and he put their money back in their sacks? They opened it up and it says they were afraid. Well, the only reason I would think they were afraid would be that they knew it was wrong to steal and they were afraid they were going to get accused of stealing. So the principle was established well before Exodus 20, which is the giving of the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not bear false witness, or thou shalt not lie. The devil lied to Eve in the garden when he said, you can eat of it and you surely won't die. Thou shalt not covet. Probably good examples of coveting would be Cain. Could be Lot. And Moses, in fact, tells the people not to be covetous in Exodus 18, which was a chapter and a half before he went up into the mountain and received them. So the importance for me of this particular overhead, and if you have trouble seeing it, feel free to come up and look at it later or ask me, and I'll give you the passages. But the importance is that we're talking about principles that are eternal, principles that are consistent with God, and things that are consistent with God are eternal. And the Ten Commandments, the principles that legislate the Ten Commandments, are not simply a Mosaical Age concept. That's why I think it's important for us to study. It was important under the Patriarchal Age, it was important under the Mosaical Age, and it's important under the Christian Age. Now, God had a reason for making a dramatic statement at Mount Sinai for the children of Israel. I believe the children of Israel, having been in slavery for 400 years, had forgotten a lot of these principles. And God needed to shake them up. And as we see in chapter 19 that we'll talk about a little bit later, there was a tremendous, tremendous experience that these people went through. Margaret, did I see your hand start to go up?
Like you have
FF?
Yeah, what's that?
Oh, FF just means verses following. So there's probably 4 or 5 or 10 verses, and you can quit reading when you want to. That's just a notation. I'm sorry, I should have. That's not a dumb question. I should have told you what that meant. I put that on a program one time for a guy to talk, and he had no idea what to do. Let me get out of the way. The covenant pericope, in essence, takes place in Exodus chapters 19 through 24. And in chapter 19, we see the preparation for the giving of the covenant. The people had to be prepared mentally and physically to receive the covenant. In chapters 20 through 23, we actually have the covenant given. The first part of chapter 20 was the Ten Commandments. And then chapters 21, 22, and 23 were some additional civil laws that were given. Okay? So we had the ethical part of it given in the Ten Commandments, and we had the civil part of it given in chapters 21 and 22 and 23. And then it was ratified in chapter 24. In chapter 24, they offered sacrifices. Moses took blood, put it in the bowl, and part of it he sprinkled over the people, and part of it, we're told in the book of Hebrews, he sprinkled over the law that was written. And there, then it was ratified. And as far as I'm concerned, it would be in that 24th chapter that the Mosaical Age really began. That's when the people ratified and accepted the law. And just one other thing on this particular one that I'll comment on. I think the giving of the Ten Commandments, the purpose of the giving of the Ten Commandments was to make God's people holy. That's been God's desire from the very beginning, to sanctify and make His people holy. God wants us to be like Him. He says it in Leviticus 11 and 44. He says, "Be ye holy as I am holy." He wants them to be separated. He brought this mob of people out of Egypt, and they were a disorganized mob of people, and he had to turn them into a nation somehow. And that was the giving of the law, and that was one of the primary purposes of the giving of the law. Any questions or comments up to that point before I go any further? Okay, it's important to remember that the book of Exodus really is about the atonement of God's people. And He atoned them with blood at the Passover, and then He atoned them or saved them with water as they crossed over the Red Sea. But the whole purpose of the book of Exodus is to deliver God's people, to sanctify them, and to set them apart. I think there are six key theological issues to get out of the Ten Commandments before we actually go to the first one. First of all, God is monotheistic. Okay, this was a new concept for the people. There are three kinds of theism that you can have. You can be polytheistic, you can be henotheistic, or you can be monotheistic. And this was the first major written attempt to make God's people monotheistic, or have only one God. It was an extremely important step in the study and in the realization of God. It was to teach them that God is spiritual and not physical. We know God is spirit today, but the people back then and many people today don't grasp that, and their gods are physical rather than spiritual. And we'll talk about that when we get to that particular commandment. There's a tremendously high value placed on holiness. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not take the Lord. All of them deal with becoming like God. But it's first of all important that you understand what God is, because you can't become like something you don't understand. I think it's one of the problems people have is they want to become Christians and they don't understand Christ. And you simply can't do that. You can't become like something if you don't know what it is. You can't become like God, which in essence is what becoming holy is, unless you understand what God is. You can't worship God without loving man. Okay, the first four were Godward, deals with man's relationship with God, and the last six are manward, and they deal with man's relationship with man. And you can't separate those. You can't be a Christian and not love your fellow man, and you can't really love your fellow man unless you love God, because the essence of loving is to want what's best for people, and what's best for people is for us to share God with them. So you can't really love man without loving God, and you can't love God without loving man. And that was the theology that they were trying to initiate here. I believe God was trying to initiate as He taught these people. Fifthly, He was trying to teach them that sin is inwardly motivated or generated. The very last commandment, "Thou shalt not covet," that's an inwardly motivated manifestation. It's been said that the 10th commandment, "Thou shalt not covet," is in essence the backbone of all the others, because all of the first nine have to do with some form of coveting. It's either placing someone higher than God or placing yourself higher than God. Killing is coveting, placing your life above someone else. Adultery is coveting, placing your desires above someone else. Theft is coveting. Lying is coveting. I think you can make a real strong case that all of the first nine commandments really can be boiled down to thou shalt not covet. Now, God didn't do it quite that simply because I don't think the people would have understood all of the ramifications, and I don't think we would. And the sixth one is the establishment of a mediator between God and man. You remember when Moses went up on the mountain and God spoke? The people, right after God spoke the Ten Commandments to him, they went running to him, and what did they ask? Anybody remember? They were afraid to hear him, and they said, Moses, you be the mediator. Let God talk to you, and then you talk to us. That was the establishment of the mediator. Okay? I believe, and we're going to take a look at chapter 19 in just a few minutes, I believe in chapter 19 that might not have been God's first preference, because he talks about them being a nation of kings. And I think you can make a real good case that God wanted all of them to be a nation of priests, I'm sorry, all of them to be priests, but they simply weren't ready for it at that time. Okay, any comments or questions on that? I want to talk just a little bit about the delivery of the law and the timing and the dates after that. Okay, I'm just going to put this one up here for a very brief time. This is a listing of the 12 Jewish months, the sacred months. The Jewish people had two calendars. They had a civil calendar and they had a sacred calendar. This is the sacred calendar. And that's a listing of the 12 months. And then since they didn't have quite the right number of days in a year, they had this month that would kick in every about 17 times every 19 years to make it come out. But it was in the month of Nisan. If you look at Exodus chapter 12, verses 1 and verses 18, that the children of Israel left Egypt. They left Egypt. And when did they leave Egypt? Right after the Passover. Okay, the first initiation of the Passover. Now if you'll turn over to Exodus chapter 19 and look at verse 1. We find out when they arrived at Mount Sinai. And when did they arrive at Mount Sinai? The third month, okay. So we're down. We left in this month, and we arrived in this month. And I just put in the side here to give you, this would be springtime and early summer. Okay. So they got to Mount Sinai maybe a couple of weeks ago by our calendar, somewhere around the first part of June. Now, what day of the first month would they have left Egypt? If it was right after Passover, what day would they have left? Remember what day of the month Passover is? Of the Jewish month. Passover is the 14th day of Nisan. Okay, sometimes it's called Abib. I put that in parentheses. Passover is the 14th day. So they would have left probably either that right after that, and I would probably say about the 15th day. The reason I'm going to a little bit of detail on this is I think there's a very interesting concept here that at least works for me. I'm not contentious about it. There are a lot of people that agree with what I'm going to tell you, and there are some good thinkers that don't agree with it. And I can't absolutely prove it one way or the other. But follow me. Follow this, because I think if you believe in types and shadows, this is a beautiful type and shadow of the New Testament. Okay, we know that they arrived at Mount Sinai on the third month. They left Egypt right after the Passover, which would have been about the 15th. So a month and a half. The rest of the first month and all of the second month. Okay, the Jewish calendar, they had 30 days. Okay, so if you leave on the 15th, you've got 16 days in that month and 30 days in the next month. So it took them roughly 46 days from the time they left Egypt until they got to Mount Sinai. Okay, In chapter 19, we're told once they get to Mount Sinai, Moses was called up into the mountain in verse 3. Then he comes back down out of the mountain, and the people are given 3 days to sanctify themselves. Okay? If you add up all of those, 46, 1, and 3, you get to 50. Now, what occurs 50 days after Passover? Pentecost. So you've got a real interesting, I think, type and shadow here of the Mosaical law when Moses finally went up into the mountain and the law was began to be disseminated was probably about 50 days after Passover. And of course, if you're Bible students, you understand the relevance of that to the New Testament because it was on Pentecost that the Christian dispensation really began. Okay? Now, if I'm going to present something to you, I ought to present what the critiques of this are. And the biggest criticism that, that other people will come up with is that up here where it says the first day of the third month, that's not really the third month of the Jewish calendar. It's the third month after they left Egypt. That just doesn't work for me because the Jews were too diligent in keeping of their calendars and they tuned that to the moon. So I don't really accept that. But some learned scholars do accept that, but there's learned scholars that do accept this. It's not original with me. But I think in terms of God's overall plan, I think he probably gave us a rather subtle type and a shadow here because it was about 50 days after they left, after the first Passover, that this giving of the law process seemed to have been initiated. And you have to remember that the giving of the law wasn't just a snap. They didn't go up there and Xerox things and bring them down. This was probably at least a 12 or 15 week process. I know it took 80 days. It may have taken longer, but we know that it took 80 days because Moses went up to the top of the mountain twice and he says, I stayed there 40 days both times. So that's 80 days for sure. And if you want to put any gap in between when he went up and when he came down, it's even longer than that. I pronounce it Sivan, but I've never had anyone that knew pronounce it for me. So I won't claim scholarly pronunciation. Sivan's a pesticide.
There's 4 months in their calendar year that has 29 days.
Yeah. Well, they would average 29 and a half, really. But you can't have a half a day. But they would still, well, I don't have it up there. They would still have to place that other month in there 7 times every 19 years to keep it in sync with the solar. This was based on the lunar. Okay? If you've got your Bibles, let's take a look at Exodus chapter 19 because I think that's very important. In Exodus chapter 19, we have the second occurrence of theophany. In the book of Exodus. And theophany is when God visually presents himself to the people. The first time we have it was back in Exodus chapter 3, and that's when Moses in the burning bush. Okay, and it's interesting, where did that take place? Where did Moses go meet God on the burning bush?
Same place.
Absolutely. And you'll find some places they'll call that Mount Horeb. Some people will call that Mount Sinai. They're just interchangeable. There's one theory that says there's two peaks, and one's called Sinai and one's called Horeb, but I've looked at pictures and I can't find two peaks. I think it's two names for the same place, Mount Horeb and Mount Sinai. But it's interesting. God appeared to Moses both times at the same place, at the exact same place. Okay. If you go down through chapter 19, you're going to see, first of all, as I said, this is another example of God presenting himself to his people. And if you notice in verse 5, there's a condition for these people being God's people. What's the condition God places on them? If what? Okay, if you'll obey. That's the condition. It's set up even before he gives it. They've got to obey in order to be called his people. Okay, in verse 6, there's an interesting phrase too. And we won't go through this whole chapter, but I wanted to point this out. He says in verse 6, and ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests. Now, did the children of Israel have priests at this time? No. No, and then explain it. Whoever said that. Jerry?
Well, they were to come out of the tribe of Levi.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry.
Well, you don't want to answer? You don't want the mic? Well, there might be somebody listening that wants to gleam every gem. Okay, go ahead. right. It's not a trick question, but you could answer that question either way. Yes, they did have priests, but no, they weren't of Aaron's descendants yet. Okay, the priesthood had not yet been established. Probably the priests that they had at this time were the elder people of each family, kind of like Melchizedek was. But I think there's an interesting insight into God's plan here in the sixth verse, and I'll pass it along to you. I think it was God's initial plan that these people would all be priests of God, because that's what He did with the Christian dispensation. If you go to 1 Peter chapter 2 and 9, it says that we are all a royal priesthood. I believe that was God's intent here. But the people simply weren't ready for it. They established the golden calf, and it was after that that they then established the Levitical priesthood. Now, God hasn't given me a divine revelation that said that was in His mind all along, but I don't know how to explain verse 6 that says, your whole nation's supposed to be priests. That's the plan He wanted, and that's the plan He instituted under the Christian dispensation. The people had to be sanctified, and they had to do three things. They had to wash, they had to wash their clothes, and they had to avoid physical relations with their mates. He set boundaries around the mountain, and the penalty for death of the people coming up the mountain in verse 12, the penalty for touching, coming too close to the mountain, was death. And this is repeated again in Hebrews as Paul writes. And then it really gets fun. I'm going to read verses, starting with verse 16. Try to visualize what these people must have been feeling when this law was being given. I can't fully. And it came to pass on the third day in the morning that there were thunders and lightning and a thick cloud upon the mount and the voice of the trumpet exceeding loud, so that all the people that was in the camp trembled. And Moses brought forth the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the neither part of the mountain. And Mount Sinai was altogether on a smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in a fire, and the smoke thereof ascended as the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked. So here these people are surrounding the mountain. It's thundering, it's lightning, there's smoke spewing out of the top of the mountain, it's covered with a cloud, and the earth's quaking. Now that would be an experience. That's just about all I can say about it. If you like to think of this fire and lightning and quake and wind, think again of Acts chapter 2, the day of Pentecost, when it had the Holy Spirit come as cloven tongues and fiery tongues. It was like a wind. This would even have been more spectacular, because I think it was further reaching. But this was a tremendous, tremendous experience for these people, and one that really instilled fear into them. And when the voice of the trumpet sounded long and waxed louder and louder, Moses spake, and God answered him by voice. And then he says, come on up into Mount Sinai. But this is a tremendous... We know we're probably talking about almost a million people surrounding this mountain, and all of this going on, taking really all of the fortitude they had to stay. My feet would have been running north, south, east, or west when all of this was going on. No wonder at the end of chapter 20, the people said, we can't take it anymore. We need a mediator. Talk to Moses. Don't talk directly to us. And this cloud that hovered over them and came down on the mountain, I believe, was the same cloud that they followed out of Egypt. The Jews call it the Shekinah glory. It's the same cloud that ultimately dwelt in the most holy place of the tabernacle that they were going to build in just a few short months. But the cloud was the presence of God. I don't know if we'd be different if we would have seen and experienced this, but I think we would be changed. Whether that be for better or for worse, I don't know. It makes the fact that these people turned away and built an idol while Moses was up the first 40 days even more incredible to my imagination. Having witnessed this and then build an idol to replace the Lord within 6 or 7 weeks after that is almost mind-boggling, but I suspect we do things just as bad. One more of an introductory note. And this is a little bit of a hodgepodge, but it's an important hodgepodge. The Ten Commandments were first of all verbally given by God. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 1, God spoke them. Then after He spoke them, He had Moses come up into the mountain,
and he gave them to him in written form. Okay? They were written by the finger of God, Exodus chapter 31 and 18. That's the only part of the law that God verbally gave himself and physically wrote. Okay, I believe the rest of the law was given by angels, and we'll talk about some passages about that. And the Ten Commandments were placed in the Ark of the Covenant. Does anybody remember what else was placed in the Ark of the Covenant? Besides Margaret, who just worked on it. Pot of manna and Aaron's rod. Okay, that's found in Hebrews. I touched on this second section. The first four of the Ten Commandments were Godward. They had to do with spiritual values. The next six were more social oriented. But that's why in Matthew 22, 37 through 39, he says, what's the greatest commandment? Love God. Next, love man. You just can't separate those two. And this early, God was instilling that in his people. Because the principles of God are eternal. And the same principles that govern Christianity govern them. Not the same laws, but the same principles. Because if it wasn't the same principles, then God wouldn't be the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And he is. Ten Commandments were given by God, and yet John chapter 1 and verse 18 tells us no man saw God. I don't believe Moses saw the face of God. I believe Moses was face to face with God. There's a difference between seeing God's face and being face to face. I think they had there was a science fiction movie that used the phrase of a mental meld. I can't remember which one. But they couldn't see his face and live. That's what John says. But yet he saw the presence so much that when he came down, he had to have the veil. And that was to keep it from dissipating and then people seeing that. The law was given by angels. Okay, remember, they were at Mount Sinai a long time. At least probably a year, at least 11 months. A lot of things went on. We focus on the Ten Commandments of Mount Sinai. But the law was given by angels. I might turn to a couple of those passages just and read those. Stephen says it in Acts chapter 7 and verse 53. Who have received the law by the dispensation of angels and have not kept it. And a couple of other references. Paul says it in Galatians chapter 3 and verse 19. And he also again says it in Hebrews chapter 2 and 2. Now, that's the law, not the Ten Commandments. God gave the Ten Commandments because they were so essential. But his angels, I believe, disseminated to Moses the rest of the law. God wrote the Ten Commandments on stone with his own finger. Moses wrote the rest of the law and brought it down in the form of a book. Sure.
The law then that Moses finally brought down after that was after God's finger also on Moses' right.
You mean the law or the second set of Ten Commandments? I believe that was also by God's finger. I believe that's indicated in Numbers and Deuteronomy.
It's indicated both ways.
Yeah. My belief is God wrote it. Now there is a difference. When the first set of Ten Commandments were given, God provided the stones and wrote on them. The second set, God told Moses to bring the stones, but I believe God also wrote them. Okay. But after the Ten Commandments, then I see God somewhat receding in terms of being the active giver and turning that job over to the angels, and they communicated then with Moses. And it was as if God had said it. But God put special emphasis on the Ten Commandments. Okay, if you look at Exodus 19, we see them coming to Mount Sinai on that first day of the third month. If you look at Numbers 9, you see they're still there at the next Passover, which is 10.5 months later. So it looks to me like probably at least 11 months they were at Mount Sinai before they left. I've seen estimates up to 2 years, but I can't really put a scripture to get me past about 11 months. We don't know how much of that 11 months was spent in actually getting the law, but we do know that at least 80 days were, because Moses says he went up there twice, and he went up there for two 40-day periods. And that's in Deuteronomy 9, verses 9 and 25.
There was a lot of things going on at the foot of Mount Sinai. Not only did they get the law, they got the whole priesthood. They were told how to make the robes of the priest. They got instructions on how to make the tabernacle. And that work was done. So it was a busy 11 months. But it's erroneous for us to think of it as simply being Moses went up and got two tables of stone and that's all that happened at Mount Sinai, because that's not the case. A lot of things happened at Mount Sinai. Although, that's all we're going to talk about after now. Any questions or comments on the introductory portion? I don't apologize for that being a little bit long, but I think it will allow us to go through the subsequent commandments a lot easier if we understand really what went on and how it was given. Okay. Let's start on the first one then. We won't get very far, but I don't want to let any time. The first commandment is, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." And in verse 2, now we're in Exodus chapter 20. In verse 2, there's that famous phrase, "I am the Lord thy God." And the two words that are used in that phrase give us a great insight into this commandment, because the word for Lord initially was YHWH, which for us is unpronounceable because there's no verb in there. And it gradually got modified to Yahweh and then Yahweh, and it's ultimately the word that Jehovah comes from. Okay? The second word there, God, is the word Elohim. And that's the word we find in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. The difference between those two words is Elohim is for a general, overall God. And Yahweh was the name for the personal, specific God of the Jewish nation. So in that phrase, he's saying, "I'm your overall supreme God, and I'm your personal God." Okay? And it's interesting that in John chapter 20 and verse 28, that's the account of where Thomas was doubting. And after he stuck his finger in Christ's hands, he makes almost the exact same statement. He says, "You are both Lord and God." And I emphasize that because I believe a lot of people today they believe in God, but they don't want Him to be their Lord. Okay? They believe in this supreme being, but they don't want anyone that's a personal meddler in their everyday life. Someone that has restrictions and limitations. And you can't have Him as one without having Him as the other and being pleasing. This was a very, very sacred word for the Jews. It was almost a word that they wouldn't pronounce. When the scribes got to the scrolls and had to write that word, they would stop, go take a bath, put on clean clothes, and come back. It was that sacred for them. A tremendously powerful word for the Jews. The devil was trying to tempt Jesus. I think the devil intellectually understood that, but it didn't keep him from trying. I think he intellectually understood that, but it didn't keep him from trying. But not to get too far off, I think the devil got in over his head in Matthew, because he didn't understand all of what was going on. Because if the devil really understood that the power of God was in his death, he wouldn't have worked so hard to kill him. I think the devil was somewhat surprised when Christ was resurrected. I don't think he thought that would happen at all. Because that would have been the absolutely dumbest thing for the devil to do, is to nail Christ to the cross. And I don't think the devil's dumb. That's an aside, but I don't think the devil is omniscient. And he's not omnipresent. And he's not omnipotent or omnipotent. But God is. And that's the great distinction. A couple of other concepts. In the 20th chapter, as he gives this one, he goes back and says, "I'm the God that delivered you out of Egypt." So by using this word God, the Jews would understand this. He's reminding them, "I'm the God of creation." And then in verses 3 and 4, he says, "I'm the one that brought you out of Egypt." So he says, "I'm the Lord of creation, and I'm the Lord of redemption." That was the import of what he was trying to tell them there. We've just got a couple of minutes. Let me show you this, and we'll go back and review this just a little bit. But I made a statement earlier about there's three different stages of mankind's relationship with God. There's polytheism, and that simply believes there's lots of gods. Pick yours. There's henotheism. That believes there's one supreme God for each nation. So America would have a God, England would have a God, France would have a God, so forth. And then there's monotheism that believes there's simply one God, period. And all people have to be subject to that one God. And that's what the first commandment's all about when it says, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." Now, probably a better translation of that would be, "Thou shalt have no other gods besides me." I don't want to split hairs, but if you look at the concept of having no other gods before me, you could interpret that to say it's okay to have multiple.